The Conference Committee on State Government, Finance, and Veterans Affairs will come to order. Senator Cohen, welcome to the committee, and would you like to introduce yourself to the committee?
Well, I'm Dick Cohen. I'm just delighted to be here.
That's it?
Pretty much.
We're delighted to have you, Senator Cohen.
What I'm really looking forward to is listening to Mr. Mossman, though.
I know, isn't it fun?
Oh, yeah. Believe me.
Senator Cohen was elected to the House of Representatives the same year I was.
But, Madam
Chair, 1976.
But I was defeated in the process, which you were not.
That's correct, but then you became a senator, too, which I did not.
We would have welcomed you, Madam Chairman, at any point.
You tried hard. But instead you got Jim Gustafson, but he did a wonderful job. Anyway, on this day, we get to hear Matt Mossman from the Department of Revenue and the Assistant Commissioner talk to Ms. Steenblok talk about debit cards. And the reason that we're doing this tonight is because when the bill was up on the House floor, there were several issues that came to the attention of everyone, and there was an amendment that very likely could have gone on, and partly did, that would delay the debit cards. The issuing of the debit cards because of data privacy issues. And the part of the amendment that did get on was that there was to be a report to the legislature talking about the data privacy issues. And then after the amendment went on and we started our conference committee, I got a communication saying, please don't ask us to do that report. But we need the questions answered before we go into it, before we start. And so what was asked for on the report are things that we have to be assured of about fraud, about how the debit cards are going to be issued, about how people are going to know about them, and that there cannot be fees attached to the debit cards, and so on. And so we welcome you to the committee, and we will give you your opportunity to answer the questions as you want, and then we can follow up with questions. Senator Cohen.
Well, Madam Chair, I should just indicate I was kidding about Mr. Mossman. Just so everybody understands, folks who are newer here, that Matt was the chief fiscal analyst for the Senate for 8 years. So, and then he escaped to the Department of Revenue a couple of years ago.
And before that,
he worked in the House.
He worked for the House.
That's correct.
And that's why we always like to have Mr. Mossman before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Cohen. Madam Chair and members, Matt Mossman with the Department of Revenue, and with me is Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblok with the Department of Revenue. Appreciate your having us here tonight, and we are quite happy to answer any and all questions that came up on the House floor and others that you might have here tonight. I do have a handout. I kind of want to lay the groundwork a little bit. One of the things that the department has been engaged in for the last year and looking forward to the legislative process and the budget recommendations that we put forward was to look for opportunities where there would be ways for us to hopefully both deliver better services and if there was a cost savings as a result of doing it to find those efficiencies rather than just kind of focusing on cutting where we might be also delivering a less service or just a lower quality service. And debit cards is a conversation where Minnesota is not, would not be an early adopter necessarily. If Minnesota, as we move forward, Minnesota would now be the 10th state that would be moving forward with debit cards for refunds. So other states have been engaged in this, and we will and have been learning from them in the process of moving forward. So a little bit more background, and then what we have is a memo, Madam Chair, that we sent to you and to Chair Saxhog following the conversation on the House floor, that what we would do is walk through those questions. So we, I think in particular, what we're doing here is using the department's current authority to determine the refund mechanism, and the direction here would be that we would transition from issuing individual refunds, and so that would primarily be for the individual income tax and the renter, homeowner and renter refund programs on debit cards rather than paper checks. And this is estimated to save $475,000 per year. And in doing so, one of the key, I think, things that we maybe haven't messaged as clear on the front end is that we believe that this will be actually delivering more service and more secure service instead of less, because a taxpayer can essentially take this debit card as a check and go deposit it as they would a paper check if that's their first desired action. And to be clear on one other point, which we have gotten some questions on, we would absolutely be prioritizing and preferencing electronic deposit. Some people, we've gotten questions outside of the House floor conversation and from some others as to whether or not this would replace electronic deposit, and the answer to that is absolutely not. Our preference will always be electronic transfer and deposit, and we would continue promoting that. So what we would like to do is just, Ms. Steenblok is going to walk through some of the Q&A, and I think just in terms of talking about the general conversation about moving forward and the study, and I'd be happy to answer any specific questions as we get into that, but we think that we can answer a lot of the questions right now. Obviously, we haven't finalized the proposals, so there's some questions that we're asking. We have answers to most of the questions. We're continuing to pursue questions, and above all, our primary objective is going to be to deliver something that works well for taxpayers, our customers, and for your constituents. And that, so I think that there's a shared interest in both the data privacy issues and in the efficiency and this being an improvement. And we're happy to kind of both answer those questions, frankly, with or without a study. We think we could do it without a study, but to start answering those questions tonight and continue answering them as legislators have them moving forward. So with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Steenblok to walk through some of the Q&A.
Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Terry Steenblok, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes for the Department of Revenue. As Mr. Mossman mentioned, we did put together questions and the answers that we have thus far. One of the first questions that was asked was in reference to the standards and procedures put in place to protect the information. The Department of Revenue takes taxpayer information seriously, and making sure we protect that is our top priority. And anytime we enter into a contract with a vendor, we make sure that they adhere to the same data practices and privacy requirements that we're held to. That's written into RFPs, it's written into the contracts, and there are follow-up processes that occur throughout our time that we have the contract with those individuals. So as we are transmitting information to the financial institution that will manage the debit cards, we will make sure that those same standards are in place, and we will do what we always do, which is following up with the vendors to ensure that they are adhering to that. One added benefit that we do have with the debit card is that financial institutions are held to many different requirements as far as protecting the data of their customers and federal regulations as far as how the data is shared. So we do have that additional layer of data protection in place here as well. So they cannot, for example, share the data with other product lines within the financial institution. They have to make sure it's locked and secured as well. So we believe that, we know that the data will be protected to the same extent that we're required to protect the data.
And Ms. Steenbach, can we find these strict standards that are in place and procedures that are in place for our perusal?
Madam Chair, members, there are some high-level standards that can be shared. We don't go into extensive detail as to what those standards are because we don't want somebody to become aware of all those and to be able to work around the system. But there is some high-level information such as, again, doing site inspections, making sure that disclosure forms are signed, making sure that the information is locked, making sure it's encrypted, some of those high-level things like that.
Madam Chair, members, if I could just supplement, there's a couple of different kinds of data security and privacy, I think, categories that have where questions have come up. One is the state, all state agencies and MMB are, you know, the questions that came up on the floor around electronic transfer of information. The state is routinely transferring financial information electronically between our accounts and banks, and there's a whole system that MMB and Minute would manage with regard to that, the kind of security that applies to those kinds of that kind of transactory activity. And so that would all still be in place to the extent that it's applicable to moving to debit cards. Then there's a whole set of issues around disclosure and what either both our department and a vendor would have to do and what we would require them to do in a contract around maintaining the privacy of information once they have it and are managing it and facilitating the debit cards as a result of that. And so there's, to the extent, obviously, that that's tax information, being the tax agency, we have protocol. The federal government, the IRS, has Pub 1075 requirements, which are publicly available. It's a book about a half an inch thick that has various requirements that we follow as an agency. We also have protocol. Our data security practices are reviewed both internally by us, are reviewed by Minute, are reviewed by the legislative auditor. So I think there's a whole kind of structure around as more and more as these data practices become more relevant, obviously, to state government. There's a fairly rigorous system, I think, of maintaining and reviewing those protocols. So procedures that we have at the department level, the IRS's procedures, those would be available.
Please proceed.
The next question that came up was in reference to the government and whether or not we'll hold data on the expenditures that taxpayers are making when they're using their debit card. And the answer to that is no. We will not have access to the transaction history. In fact, we would make it very clear to the vendor that we do not want it. And so that information would not be sent to us. The vendors, however, need to track the transactions, and the reason why is because they need to keep track of the balance that's remaining on the debit card. They also do it as a way for fraud prevention. I don't know if you've ever used a credit card or a debit card and had the financial institution call you because they think there may be fraud that's occurring on your card. That would be the same for this particular situation. So that's another way that the financial institutions would use the data that they're tracking, looking for trends with whatever software that they use to manage that. And again, as I mentioned, it is our intention to make sure that we restrict access. There will not be any reporting information that comes back to us that tells us so-and-so has used the debit card, here's where they've made their transactions. We do not have a business need to know that information, and we will not be collecting it. There was a question that came up pertaining to the check printing machines. One of the things is that the Department of Revenue does not print the paper checks that are going out today. Those checks are printed by the Department of Employee and Economic Development, and they will continue to print checks for other reasons throughout the state agency. So there will not be an elimination of any machinery that's used to print those checks. We will still print a few. There will be some exceptions. We won't be doing this for businesses, so we'll continue to issue checks for businesses. And there will be some exceptions on the individual side where we'll have to continue to print checks as well. There was also a question about using the card at a convenience store. And let's say, for example, that you make a $25 purchase, but you only have $10 left on the debit card. What happens to you? Are you able to get the remainder of the money off the debit card? And the one thing that's real important, as Mr. Mossman mentioned, the debit card can be used just like a check. When you get your refund check, you can take it in and have it cashed for cash or deposited into your account at any time. If you are at a merchant and you're using that debit card to make a transaction, it's similar to like a gift card. When you have a gift card, if you only have $10 left, you're able to use that $10 towards the transaction. You'd need to tell the merchant that, you know, I have $10 remaining on the card or whatever that may be. And individuals will have access to their balance information either through a telephone customer service representative, live representative, or a computer, what they call IVR, that's the prompting system on the telephone. Or they will also have access via the website, so accessing it on their computer or their smartphone. So they will be allowed to use the remainder of the balance that is on the debit card, or again, they can take it in and get cash at any time.
Representative Newton.
Will the merchant be able to tell how much is on the card before they use the money to use the card?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Commissioner.
The merchant will not know. It's just like a gift card, so the merchant won't know how much is remaining. The taxpayer would have to, at that time, say there's $10 remaining on the card, just like you do with a gift card when you get a gift card.
When I have gift cards, the merchant always knew how much was left.
Right. In fact, it's usually printed.
Barnes and Noble.
So, I think that's where the gift card from the store.
Right. So there are times when I use the gift card at a major store, and they actually had to ask me how much was remaining on the card. So some stores may know it depending upon, so if it's like a Barnes or Noble's or something like that, they may know it. If it's a general Visa card, they may not know it depending on the merchant.
I think, Madam Chair, members, it could be wrong, but I think it depends on if you're using a card from that store, so it's their database, they would know the balance of the card. So if it's a gift card from the store that you're using it at, which would be different from if you give someone a general Visa gift card with some money on it that has to go through Visa, and you go into a store that that merchant might not automatically know how much is on the Visa gift card.
And these 120,000 Visa card opportunities that the person has in the state, I think that was the number that you gave me.
103,000, I think.
103,000. They wouldn't have be hooked up to the Visa information to get to know what's on the card.
Our understanding is that they do not have that information, and we can double check that again. But it's our understanding that the person would have to be able to say there's $10 left or try a number lower than the $25, for example.
Okay, and what about the person that doesn't have computer and doesn't have a phone, an iPhone, and doesn't have the ability to call in or whatever? How do they know what to do?
Madam Chair, the other option that is available to cardholders is a paper statement. So there is the option for them to receive in the mail a monthly paper statement that shows them the history of the transactions, similar to what we would have if we had a Visa card or a bank account.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would just seem to me that we could use the same technology that the Health and Human Services does for EBT cards, because they're people go in and buy groceries and they get a receipt telling them how much is left on it every time. I would certainly think that would be possible.
Madam Chair, members, we can look into that. I think there's a couple differences. This wouldn't be a reloadable card, and then so it would be a one-time use card. So when it's been fully used, it would no longer be able to be reloaded or reused. Okay. And there's a difference. But the other thing I think that's important to circle back to Representative Murphy and members is, again, for I think many of the constituents that you might be asking about, is remembering that it can be used like a check. I mean, you can take the debit card, because I think many folks that you might be asking about would typically get their paper check, want to take it to their bank and deposit it, which you will be able to do with upon your first receipt of the debit card, just like you would a check. So the use of it as a debit card, again, if you think about it that way, is an added option. There's no requirement that you use it for multiple uses as a debit card. You can use it just like a paper check and put it in your bank account and write checks from your bank account or withdraw cash from your bank account or any other mechanism that you might now use with a paper check.
And are they going to make that choice then on their tax form how they want their refund paid to them when they send their taxes in?
Madam Chair, no, and members, we would be moving we would essentially stop issuing paper checks and instead be issuing the debit cards.
Madam Chair, they can, however, elect on their income tax form to have direct deposit. So that's the option they would have at the time they file their income tax return, is to elect for direct deposit.
But then they have to know their routing number.
Correct.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I thought I heard, Mr. Mossman, I thought I heard you talk about, you said they want to have a phone call, they can call in voice system and go through that. And I guess, maybe it's just me, but I have, my mother doesn't like credit cards and doesn't like cash cards and doesn't own a computer. And myself, I just had an issue with a dentist bill that was a mess up with the insurance company, and trying to get through their automated system, they kept asking me my birth date. And when I said June, they kept telling me it was February. And they couldn't hear my June as being, they kept saying, did you say February? And I said, no. And I kept, so I mean, I don't like those systems myself either. It's frustrating to try and call when you say, give us your birth date, and you give it to them like they tell you, and they keep telling you, no, it's February. So
I guess there's some insurance here. I guess that's the concern I have, is people getting at their money,
not being eaten up by fees. If we don't use it in 2 years, it's going to be in the unclaimed property process. I guess that's kind of the way the checks are now. I just have some concerns about it, because there's still a vast number of people out there that may or may not have bank accounts to have it put in. And when you put it in the bank and they don't have a lot of money, it gets eaten up by fees and it disappears on you. So, I mean, I still have some concerns there with this.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, I'm happy you asked about the fees because I think that is an important, you know, part for us to get around to talking to, talking about. I think one of our biggest challenges will be in terms of educating people as we roll this out is the awareness that when you get something different in the mail that looks like a plastic card that you can use it as a check. And then I think after that will be, you know, how do you use it as a card if that's what you want to do, and around the fees. And let's maybe Ms. Steenblatt can kind of elaborate on some of the fees.
And Madam Chair, just one while he's answering, I guess the other question, you said that they'd get a statement in the mail. Would you, when you got the card originally, would there be a statement with it so you know how much is on there? Because by the time I've done my taxes, I may not remember how much I was supposed to get back.
Ms. Steenblatt.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question, and the answer to that is yes. So when they receive their debit card, they will also, because a lot of times, you know, at the time you do your taxes, your refund may be one amount, but there may be some other things that cause your refund to adjust one way or another. So they will get with their debit card a notice that tells them the dollar amount of the refund that is available. In reference to the fee area, we're looking to implement a solution that does not add unnecessary fees back to the taxpayer. And so our expectation is that from a fee standpoint, there will be no additional fees for your traditional transactions, using it at a merchant, using it at an ATM machine that would be within the network, where you will see some fees probably, and this is based on the experiences of the other states. When you do a wire transfer, for example, there would be a fee attached to that. Or if you were to use the card at an international ATM location out of the country, there would be a fee for that. But we are looking to make sure that the solution we implement does not add unnecessary fees. If they opted for the paper statement, there would not be an additional fee for a paper statement versus talking to a live person versus using, you know, the computer, press 1, press 2. And we're looking to implement some solutions that meet all the different needs of the taxpayers.
Senator Samson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then we've got three pages of questions here. I can't help but believe that a lot of these questions are going to be answered going through the three pages. But the next question about the senior citizens and their particular problems, the first dot says this process aligns with the process in place by Social Security. And Social Security has been doing this for how long now?
May 1st of 2011, they notified recipients that they must receive it that way. They didn't enforce it until March 1st of this year. So as of March 1st of this year, they have been doing that. And the first group we met with when we talked about doing this was a group of members from AARP. And we said, here's what we're looking to do. And we wanted to get their feedback because we knew that they were an important demographic for us. So we did meet with them, share with them what we were looking to do, and ask them to provide us with their feedback and questions that they had. And we have implemented those things that they talked about into the expectations of this. But overall, they were the ones that pointed out to us as well that Social Security does already do this, and it's just becoming a normal practice. So.
Senator, Representative Newton.
Just an observation is that with gift cards and something that looks like gift cards, a lot of people hang on to them and don't use them. And I don't see if you issue the card, but as opposed to issuing a one-time check without a monthly statement that goes with it. The other thing is, do these cards have expiration dates on them?
Mr. Mossman. Representative Newton, I'll start, and Ms. Steenblatt will have something to add, I know. The I mean, first of all, the unclaimed property, paper checks oftentimes can go for 2 years without being used now. So we have that same issue now with paper checks. And the unclaimed property statutes would apply to these debit cards just like they do to paper checks, so that the whole process of we would be working with the bank and the vendor would be required after the allotted amount of time in statute expires, that they would have to let us know and have a process for essentially sending the money back to us so that we could follow the state's unclaimed property statutes and look for a way to get the correct amount of money that is owing to the individual who received it on the card.
But you're still issuing monthly statements all that time, and I don't see, you know, issuing the statement plus the postage, how you're saving a lot of money.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members. The vendor would be paying that. It would be helpful, I think, just to say a couple things about why the vendor would do this and why we save money. Merchant fees are not charged in the industry, like using a Visa card, and merchant fees are not charged to the card holder and to the person using the debit card. They're charged to the merchant. So, you know, merchants, presumably, if they're going to increase the price of their product to cover that, it's already in the price of their product, or they're paying that from the merchant to Visa, they're not reducing the amount of the debit card as a result of those merchant fees. So, you know, that is partly helps kind of give an understanding of the interest in of the vendor versus the interest of the state and how we can both.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
There was a question pertaining to the process and procedure to replace the card if it's lost or stolen. If the card were to become lost or stolen, the one nice thing that we have is that the card can be stopped immediately, and so any funds that were not used would be frozen from being used. So if the taxpayer lost the card or it was stolen, they would simply contact the vendor, and the vendor would stop that card just like they would for you and I if we lost our debit or credit card. So it would be stopped immediately by calling the vendor, and then the vendor would reissue a new card to them. There was also a question pertaining to what is the liability if somebody else uses the card. The card holder is not held liable for unauthorized purchases that are made to the card. So if for some reason you know, the card is lost, or somebody picks it up and uses it, or they give somebody their PIN number, they're not held liable for unauthorized purchases unless they're found to be a participant in the fraud scheme with their card, or they're negligent in that they gave their PIN number to somebody else and gave them the card, and that person did not use it. And that's the same that applies to you and I in the event that we did that with our debit card in today's world. So they're not held liable if somebody does steal it and use it, and they are made whole as far as the funds that...
Is the state then the one that makes them whole?
Madam Chair, members, it's actually the vendor. So if it was a Visa card, it would be Visa. If it was MasterCard, it would be MasterCard as part of their insurance per se. They're responsible for making them whole.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you just hit on something I'm looking here. The PIN number. Now, every time I get a credit card in the mail or get a new card, they send you the PIN number separately, so I'd be getting the card and a few days later getting the PIN number, so I wouldn't be able to use it right away at a cash machine without the PIN number. So there'd be a delay there. They're not going to be sending the PIN with the card, I'm assuming.
Madam Chair,
Mrs. Dean Block.
The way that the process works is that you get the card, and then you would have to authenticate the card, so you have to activate the card. And at the time you activate the card, that's when you would choose a PIN number that you would want to use as part of the activation process. In order to activate it, it would be a particular identification, maybe the last four digits of a Social Security number. We want the opportunity to meet with the other states and figure out what's worked for them, so we haven't landed on authentication process for sure, but one of the ways that a lot of states are doing it is through the use of a portion of the Social Security number.
When do you anticipate?
It's Mary's magnetic personality.
So, Madam Chair and members, we're looking at both what might be required under federal law in terms of the Social Security number and working with financial institutions because they have some obligations under federal law. It also, if we use that number for the authentication process, that would have a benefit of not really having to provide any PIN number to the taxpayer at all. They would be able to authenticate the card using their Social Security number, which would mean that we wouldn't have to send any authentication number in the card. So it would be secure from the standpoint that you're the only one that knows your Social Security number or a part of your Social Security number to authenticate the card. But as Ms. Dean Black says, we're still working. That hasn't been finalized, but there would be, just like any plastic that you have to be used now, some intent to have some sort of card or number that only the individual would know to authenticate the card. Which, you know, to circle back a little bit, we genuinely think, and we're working with other states to be reassured of this, would enhance security, not make it less secure. I mean, right now, if you get a paper check in the mail and someone goes mailbox to mailbox and is picking up a paper check, which does happen, you could go around from place to place to check cashing business until you find someone who's willing to cash that check or create a fake ID to go with that check to cash the check, whereas if you have an individual number that only you are aware of that you can authenticate the card, we think there will actually be less personal information both in the envelope and transacted with the plastic, with the debit cards that make them more secure or not.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mossman, I guess I had a chill go up my back when you talked about you verifying it with their Social Security number, because that would mean that it would have to be on the card, on the magnetic strip on the card, if you're using that for information, if that's what you can use as a PIN number. And maybe I'm just an odd duck here, but my parents got mine and my siblings' Social Security numbers all at the same time, and they just happened to be right in a row, right down the list. So I know my siblings' Social Security number because they're just one digit off. So I mean, I think there's other people that might have similar situations.
Ms. Dean Block.
Representative. So just to clarify, what will happen is you'll get the card in the mail, and at the time you get the card in the mail, you know, there may be a sticker on it that says call this 800 number to activate your card. When you activate that card, that would be that the Social Security number will not be stored on the magnetic strip. When you activate the card, that would be the time, say for example, we said you need to enter the three middle digits of your Social Security number. At that point, you would enter those three digits, and then the system would ask you to choose a PIN number for yourself that only you know, and you would select a PIN number for that particular card. And then when you use the card at a merchant as a debit card, you would enter that unique PIN number that you selected for yourself, or if you used it at an ATM, you would enter that PIN number that you selected for yourself, but not your Social Security number.
Please continue.
There was a question as to what the cost would be to implement this and what the cost would be if we decided it didn't work and we wanted to pull it back into the current process that we use today. And this does not cost the state anything. And as Mr. Mossman mentioned, the banks or the financial institution is responsible for the fee portion of that. So there is no cost to the state. If we decided to stop issuing debit cards and pull the process back in to the state, then there would be the cost of the $475,000 annually. There was a question about small businesses in rural Minnesota.
And just a moment then. And that's the current cost.
Yes.
Of issuing like you're doing now.
Correct, Madam Chair. There was a question about small businesses in rural Minnesota that only accept cash. And again, just to reiterate, it does work just like the refund check you get today. You can take that into the bank and you can get cash for it. You also have the additional flexibility if you were to go to a merchant that did accept debit cards. You have the additional option of being able to get cash back if that's something the merchant offered. So if I took my debit card into Terstegs and I purchased something and they allow the option to give you cash back, you can request more and then get that additional cash back there as well. But again, for the areas that only accept cash, the taxpayer still has the option of getting cash for it too immediately, just like they would their paper check. And there were some questions that came up pertaining to fraud issues, and we've visited with the other states who have implemented this extensively to learn from them and what their experiences are. And you know, while nothing is 100% foolproof or fraud-proof, the other states have indicated that they have not seen the fraud issues associated with the debit cards that they see with paper checks. And some of the issues that we believe that this will prevent is there's less information on the debit card versus the paper check. So when you're using that debit card, it has your name and the number identified for the debit card. If you're taking your check into a check cashing place, for example, it has your name, it has your address. A lot of times when they're verifying to cash your check, they ask you for your date of birth and your driver's license number, and they write that information on the check. We don't have those types of issues associated with the debit card. In today's world, when the department issues you your refund check, it actually comes as your check, and then there's a perforated, you know, stub on it, and it's got that seal around it. So it clearly looks like a check, if you're familiar with that. So it's much easier for somebody to identify that's a check, take that, and maybe take it to a check cashing facility or somewhere else to check cash that. When the debit cards are issued, they're issued in a plain white envelope that does not identify them as a paper check. So it's less likely that somebody would be able to tell that this is a paper check and present that. Again, as part of the authentication process, they will be required to put a personal PIN number that is something that is known only to them. The other thing that we did, too, is we contacted all the check cashing places in the Twin Cities area and asked them if they would cash the debit card for us. And none of them would take a debit card or to cash, to give you cash in exchange for that. So we don't have the risks that we sometimes have with folks going into the check cashing places where we see maybe more potential for fraud. And we don't have people coming out of those facilities with large amounts of cash, which makes them more vulnerable as well. If you are using it,
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And that's a lot of the people that don't have bank accounts use those check cashing places. So, and they won't cash a check for you if you have, if you don't have an account at a bank. So, are they going to, all banks going to accept these? If I don't have an account there, I can walk into Wells Fargo or First Bank, or that's not First Bank anymore, but can I walk into a bank I don't have an account at, and they're going to cash these for me even though I don't have that account?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Commissioner.
The answer to that is yes. So you would, so again, depending upon if it's Visa or MasterCard, wherever it is, they can take it to any financial institution that accepts those types of cards and get cash for them. They can use it at an ATM as well. So that's one of the benefits behind this, is that they don't have to rely on these check cashing places and some of the fees that are associated with them being able to cash their refund check.
Please continue.
The other benefit that we see from a fraud standpoint is that if the taxpayer was using the debit card to make an online purchase, whenever you're making online purchases, it typically asks for the four-digit code either on the front of the card or on the back of the card, and they cannot make the purchase without having that number. So we have that benefit here as well as an extra security layer. They would have to be in possession of the card and know that number in order to make online transactions. And the other thing, too, is that the debit card system allows for freezing of the balance immediately when it's compromised. And sometimes with the paper checks, the person may not know it, or by the time they found out, all the funds are gone, whereas with the debit card, it gets frozen right away, and they don't have the delay of trying to get all the funds back. We have a greater likelihood of making those funds that they had left on the card available to them right away.
Madam Chair and members, the last two questions that were on your handout related to merchant fees, and I think in the course of our conversation to this point, we covered those both in terms of how merchant fees work and how that is the incentive for the merchants, and that fee does not reduce the balance on the card or accrue to the user of the card. So with that, we would be happy to answer any additional questions, and I would genuinely invite you, as you think about this over the next coming days and weeks or months, if you have concerns or thoughts as we're trying to finalize this, that you do please forward them to us, and we would be happy to answer them. And be, you know, one of the things moving forward with this is that we will need to put together a robust communication and education plan. We know that that's part of our responsibility and portfolio to help answer as many of these questions as we can in a user-friendly way, so that users of the cards, when they begin receiving them, have the information that they need as best possible to use.
And Mr. Mosman, has that started, that robust communication plan?
It has actually, Madam Chair. When we, in the instructions that we have issued for this tax year, on the individual income tax return instructions and the homeowner renter refund instructions, we have made a splashy front page notice that we will be moving to debit cards beginning in 2014, and we've had some other press in a more modest way, but we have started to put that together and communicate.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
We've also notified all the volunteers that work at our VITA sites, so our volunteer income tax preparation sites and AARP, so that they can educate taxpayers this year as they were filing returns to let them know that next year they'll have one of two options available to them. And then we've also outreached to a couple different nonprofit groups to let them know that it's coming, and again, asking for their feedback as to how we can implement it.
So, since this has already started, then you think that this committee must approve it?
Madam Chair and members, we have the authority to do this. If the legislature told us not to, we would not do it, obviously. And to just reiterate what I said at the beginning of the conversation, we're fully prepared to make an independent assessment to either do this at a later time. If we don't feel like we're ready to carry, there's going to be questions because this is going to be changed. So we know that we're going to have to weather some amount of questions and change when this move from paper checks to debit cards occurs. But if, from the standpoint of the kind of fundamental questions that you all have been asking here tonight in terms of the security issues and just the workings of the card, if those can't be solidified, and we believe they can, but if they can't be solidified in a way that we have a high comfort level that it is going to work well, we would, you know, those communications that we've started aside, we would, it's more important for us to do it right than it is to do it January 1st, 2014. So we would make that judgment at that time.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson.
So the language that was we put in with the amendment that from Representative Holberg that was just about a report, and so we're, I know her original amendment had the language of stopping it and then doing a report, and it's just right now it's just a report, so I haven't heard why they, I mean, they're saying they're going to, they can give us this information, but there's not, I haven't heard why they can't do a report yet and why that would be out of, you know, why we shouldn't leave that language in.
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, there's no reason that we can't do a report. I mean, I think, to be honest, I think a lot of the information that would be in a report would be the information that we've been, the questions we've been answering tonight. So if that's the will of the conference committee, we're happy to do the report. I think there's just sometimes a lot of report requirements out there, and our position was that we are more than happy to communicate to all of you or to put something up on our website to communicate how this works that would satisfy the same expectation without necessarily the formal report requirement, but that's, you know, we're happy to talk about that. Either way, we're very willing to be transparent with you about the issues that have been being raised. So.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. The next item on the agenda is the OET cash flow proposal found on page R9A1 on the side-by-side, Senate line 6.34 to 7.10. The language came to the House later in the process, and we didn't have time to fully explore and discuss the issue. There has been some back and forth discussion with MMB, but there is still some questions about why this provision is needed and it was included in your book, and so we thought we would like to hear more about it.
Fair enough.
And they sold you on it?
Pardon me?
They sold you on it?
We think it's a viable alternative. Again, that's good that we're going to hear about it.
Okay. Mr. Eichten, Commissioner Parnell, thank you for coming, and thank you for being willing to give us more enlightenment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand you have questions related to why OET, and I'm going to refer to OET as OET and not Minute. I know it gets kind of confusing, but I don't think we've formally had our name changed yet. But just for the sake of history,
it was OET. In Phyllis Kahn's bill on last week.
Madam Chair, yes, that's yeah. Right. So my understanding, since this happened prior to my time here, is that OET has always had the provision of having a cash reserve to cover its payroll. There are a number of reasons for that. You know, we bill in arrears so that we've already taken on those expenses before we bill an agency. Agencies are required to pay external vendors before they pay us in order to stay away from any kind of interest fees or late fees or whatever. And then we have some specific needs where we might pay a vendor a large sum up front and then charge back to that agency over the course of the next year. So in order to have that cash flow, we need to, in order to make those payments, we need to have that cash flow in place. And we have had that for as long as OET has existed. Now, we are no longer confident that we will have the right cash amount because with IT consolidation, we have grown by a factor of 7 or 8, both in terms of number of employees and budget. So we are asking for this provision so that we can have the capability of borrowing that money in case we should need it. We'll try some other ways of covering those expenses before we actually borrow that money. If all of that fails, then we do need that cash reserve and the ability to borrow that money from MMB. Again, this is not changing any of the ways that OET has done its business, but it does make for a provision for MMB to loan us that money over 2 years over the biennium rather than just for 1 year as now stated in statute.
And Madam Chair, and that's with interest, right?
That's with interest, that's right.
Rep. Sam Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, just so I got it straight in my head here, you're going to borrow the money. Are you going to then build up this fund as you go along so you have the money, so once you pay it back, you won't have to constantly borrow it from the MMB?
Madam Chair,
Commissioner Parnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, that's what we expect to do. We will only borrow it if we need it. We have other mechanisms for trying to cover these costs. For example, instead of charging an agency for all of its bill, we could just charge for the payroll portion of it. And I don't mean to cast any aspersions on agencies and any reluctance on their part to pay. I don't believe that that's the case. Sometimes we have to sort out some accuracy in the bill, and that might take time.
Mr. Eichten.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add to the point of accuracy that was just made by the Commissioner. Previously, before the SWIFT system was implemented, an agency could pay the undisputed amount of a bill, and then we could work out the remaining portion. With the implementation of SWIFT, an agency, because of bilateral netting, can only pay the full amount of a bill. So if it's, let's say, a $100,000 bill and we're disputing $10, they cannot pay the majority of that amount until we resolve that last $10. So an additional issue, in addition to the 30-day prompt payment law, that's contributing to the need for cash flow assistance, potentially.
And what was the usual amount of cash flow that you needed to borrow?
Madam Chair, I believe we have kept 14 to 15% of our budget in cash reserve.
And is that $110 million then for the future?
Correct me if I'm wrong. I have a CFO here. The $110 million is roughly 12% of our budget. The 15% that I was referring to was the past cash reserve that we were able to manage on our own, about $14 to $15 million.
And so how come you don't need 15% now, but or how do you figure that you're only going to need 12% rather than 15% in the future?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask our CFO to answer that question. It's a little detailed.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Tu Tong, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for OET.
Madam Chair and members, so OET currently has a budget roughly of about $100 million. We keep about $12 to $14 million, which is equivalent to a 2 months working capital for the operations of Minute. As we move towards fiscal 14 and 15, we are now billing for all the services at the state for IT services, and that cost from Minute or OET will go from 100 to about 450 to $500 million. As a result of that, our existing cash reserve cannot meet the demand of a larger organization. So that's why we're asking for some cash assistance as part of the operating procedure. Do that.
And how come, explain again why MMB is your bank?
Because they are the state, Madam Chair, members, I believe they're the state treasurer and the financing arm of everyone at the state, so we have to go through.
So they're everybody's bank?
Yeah.
Okay. That's from the past. Right. And so you, with $110 million, then you figure that Minute OET can meet payrolls.
Madam Chair, yes, that's the case.
Yeah. And then do you pay it back? If you borrow, you pay it back with interest?
Madam Chair, yes, we're required to pay it back with interest.
What happens when someone, well, we know what happens. You don't have the money, and so you have to borrow it. But what do you do when an agency doesn't pay you?
Madam Chair, the bilateral netting issue, in that case, I contact a chief financial officer of other agencies, and we're trying to work through. If there's credit that's due to them or a debit that's due to us, we simply work through and reissue a bill, and then that can be paid through, so the agency can make its payments.
It's a matter of agencies not paying us. It's a matter of the delay in the payments that we have to make, and they're paying us generally for good reason.
But Commissioner, doesn't every agency have the same procedures to follow about when they get billed and when they have to pay?
Madam Chair, yes, that's the case. We bill every agency every month. Some of them have very, very complex financial arrangements, federal funding rules, etc. So we can't determine what their mechanisms for payment are. We have to assume that when we bill them, they will pay us the accurate amount.
Senator Eaton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why would you not just fund OET or Minute instead of billing different agencies? I mean, this seems like a pretty complicated way to fund IT services.
Commissioner?
Senator Eaton, I'm not sure of the history of that. I believe that OET has always been a chargeback organization, which is not uncommon for IT organizations.
Senator Franson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, and I'm pretty new here, but just to give the history of, was this foreseen, because it says in the language of this Senate language, this is to deal with the differences during the initial phases of IT consolidation, which happened last session, I believe. So was this not a foreseen expense or a foreseen event, and now we have to deal with it this biennium? It just doesn't make sense if it was a big undertaking that this wasn't considered, and now we're fixing it later. Can you give a little history of that?
Commissioner?
IT consolidation was the result of legislation in 2021 session, but the financial doesn't really kick in until the next biennium. So in July, we now absorb all of the IT expenses as a major as I said, that means our budget that we have to manage has increased by a factor of about 7 or 8. So this is a mechanism to take care of it in this next biennium. We have not needed it by
Senator Franzen?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems like it was known that this was going to be an expense, but it wasn't factored in until the next legislature. It just seems like one of those shifts that we've been having to deal with after the fact, and just doesn't seem to be thought through if we're going to have a major undertaking of a consolidation that we should be able to pay for it. I think that's why I think there's a lot, at least for myself, some confusion why we're dealing with this now, as opposed to when enabling legislation took place that we actually could fund it at that time.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Tong,
there was always an indication that we would need the cash. It's just that the language that MMB has been given can only provide cash within the fiscal year. Mm-hmm. Our needs expanded fiscal year, a biennium. So as a result of that, we had to get language. So we knew there was a need for cash. We thought the mechanism was there to get it, but I didn't know that it required 2 years to get that.
And Commissioner Primer.
IT consolidation was not funded. We did not get any money to do any IT consolidation. So we are happy to pay for it ourselves.
Yeah, that explains a lot.
Did MMB know that this was going to be a problem ahead of time?
Madam Chair, in terms of need for cash, I believe that they knew that there was a need for a cash flow assistance. To the magnitude, I don't think they know, but to the magnitude. And the $110 million is the worst case scenario. We didn't want to have to go back because there was a miscalculation or some timing with invoices. So I, in calculating the need for cash, I adjust the timing. I make sure that we are looking at the worst case scenario. And like the commissioner said earlier, we're working on ways to mitigate some of the needs. But just in case we have a need, we didn't want to have to go back and ask this committee or another committee for more.
Senator Eaton.
Madam Chair, I was just going to say I was pretty sure that this was unfunded, this consolidation, and that they really weren't given the option of having funds to deal with it.
Right. Commissioner Parnell.
Madam Chair, members, I'm not sure that I would consider this a problem per se. This is the way that OET has done business. We have written in legislation that the Commissioner of MMB can grant us money should we need it. So this is not new. The amount is different, and the fact that we are asking that MMB have the capability of going beyond one fiscal year to two is what's different. This is the way we do business. It is not a major change for us from pre-consolidation.
And then could you tell us why this was not in your budget proposal, why it came in after?
Madam Chair, committee members, I would consider this more of an adapting or cleanup language. It is not budget adapting. It's not a request for money from the legislature. It's clarifying language so that we can continue to operate the way we have been operating.
And then did it come, Senator, did it come to you in the overview, or did it come to you in a bill? Or did it come to you as an ask?
Well, Madam Chair, it came to us as a part of the presentation by Minute and OET in our committee.
Okay.
Any other questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I heard you when I asked this first time. So this is a one-time authorization. This isn't going to be in there 2 years from now when we do the budget again. There's going to be you're going to build up a reserve, so we have going forward, you have a reserve to deal with this going forward, assuming we don't throw a bunch of more people at you and greatly expand the size of your minute again.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, that's the expectation, that if we need it, we will need it in the next 2 years.
Mr. Tong.
Representative members, there might be, based on our cash outlook, there might be a small need as we build up reserve. We can't build it fast enough, otherwise we'd be over recovering too much. So there might be a small need in the next biennium for us to have a cash flow system, but not to the level that we're requesting now. But there might be a small portion. I could not say no, but there might be a small portion.
Is there someone from MMB here that wants to tell us that this is just fine? That you're really into it?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Micah Intermill, Executive Budget Officer with MMB. I am here to say this is just fine and we're really into it.
Good for you.
Set him up, man.
Well, you know, he's from Nebraska, so it's a special place in my heart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, all kidding aside, MMB does see this as a manageable cash flow issue that won't affect the overall state's cash flow or create any extra pressures that would require us to extend a line of credit or engage in any external borrowing. This is, to given the late hour, to briefly and succinctly
explain this. Oh, but we just started,
this,
so it's okay.
the state recognizes a grouping of funds that constitute the statutory general fund. And within that are the general fund as we know it, other funds such as the healthcare access, the health impact fund, in fact. And all of those the statutory general fund doesn't include the constitutionally directed funds, the legacy funds, the federal fund, pensions, those are all left out of it. But under the statutory general fund, since the money is all under the same umbrella, we have the authority under law to move funds, move monies between the individual funds. So, as has been mentioned before, this sort of thing takes place pretty regularly. The only exception here is that we're going between fiscal years, as opposed to within the same fiscal year. So again, and additionally, I should say that though $110 million is the largest we've seen of this kind, we don't see it posing a problem for the cash flow of the state. So for those reasons, roughly, we do not see this as a problem.
And Mr. Intermill, then this two-year thing, that will continue, right, the cash flow?
So if as the spreadsheet reflects, we see the money going out in 14, coming back in 15, so it'll all be recovered within the biennium.
Okay. Ms. Roberts, do I have any other questions?
Madam Chair, members, I think some of the concern of the fiscal staff was coming out of the discussions that happened about 3 years ago when the state was in a facing serious cash flow issues, and we just wanted to make sure that there was assurance that this language wasn't going to lead to those kind of problems. And I think another issue I raised with you was just making certain that the demands of the OET cash flow didn't hit at the same time as the demands of the general fund, that there's a cycle to that and some assurance of that it would all work.
And Madam Chair, members,
Mr. Andrew Mill.
To Ms. Roberts' point, the major spikes that were seen a few years ago were directly related to the school shift. And whereas then we were paying 60-40 split, 60 in the current year, 40 in the next year, we're now at a point where we're at 86-14. So we're roughly paying a third of what we were paying then. And so we do see room there and do not see a concern.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Senator, that concludes our agenda and answers our questions. And we are much more knowledgeable now than when we were at 7:30.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you are. I am, too. Probably the rest of the commission. So, any idea on what we should move yet?
That's up to you. You're the chair.
All right. Well, I might say that just as some... As you had a couple of very good subjects that we dealt with tonight, I think that we're going to probably be taking a look at the Department of Administration procurement language, the Historical Society and their educational outreach and access to historical resources, and we'd like to take a look at the Compensation Council's recommendations at some point, too. So those all may be subjects. It may happen tomorrow, depending on what happens. I know that both bodies have some pretty interesting stuff coming before them and before committees tomorrow, so we'll try to have this next meeting at kind of a convenience, but it does appear that these evening meetings are when things aren't happening, and we can all, we have great attendance tonight, that really helps. So with that, Madam Chair, we'll let everybody know when the next meeting is.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.